Welcome to Your Aged Care Compass podcast. Join us to find out how to support your older loved ones at home. We're going to help you make sense of Australia's aged care system. We talk about legal and financial considerations for aging and how chronic health conditions impact your older loved ones' well-being. And we share real life stories of where it went wrong for people and how we got them back on track.
Welcome to today's episode of Your Aged Care Compass podcast, everybody. I'm Coral, your host, and I'm joined by Gary Hartrick today, who is a GP in my local hometown of Cairns. Gary's been working as a GP here for 40 years, so lots and lots of experience and knowledge. And Gary still has some teaching responsibilities at our local university here, James Cook University. Welcome to the show, Gary.
Thank you very much for having me along, Coral. I really appreciate the invitation.
Fantastic. Look, I talk a lot about the support older people can access from our aged care system, but we haven't had a conversation with the GP yet, who can also provide assistance to older people or older patients. Sometimes the person's GP might be the first person that the elderly person or their family talks to about age-related illnesses or functional decline. This being the case, I'd like to enlighten our listeners how a person's GP can support them to remain well and able in their own home. In your experience, if a family member voices concerns about their elderly parent, what are the more common things they'll raise with you, if there are concerns that are more common?
Well, Coral, there are some specific things that they're more likely to present with, either with their parent in tow or separately via a visit or a phone call. But I should preface my remarks in saying that for a long time, aged care has been becoming a bigger problem, obviously because we've got an aging society. But also because I think the whole attitude towards the aged has changed culturally over the distance. And there's an old adage that says a community can be judged by the way it looks after its elderly, I think has never been more relevant than today. Having said that, when we do get people coming concerned about their older relatives, be they mother, father, sometimes brother or sister or aunts or uncles, there's probably three main issues that are presented. First one is probably physical issues, becoming more frail, at risk of falling or perhaps having falls already, and the fear that either the older person or their family have about them falling over and not being found at home for goodness knows how long. That's obviously an issue. Also, I mean, their decreased dexterity, things like this are going to be an issue with cooking, cleaning, accidents happening, all these types of things. So they're worried about the way they're going to function. The next one is probably also very common. That's cognition, becoming more forgetful. So forgetfulness, as we get older, you do develop these cognitive dysfunctions. They're minor to start with, but then they seem to progress. And it may start with forgetting names, but then it goes on to forgetting how to do the shopping, how to remember passwords to the computer. I'm guilty of that myself. Watch out, Gary. And places, events, getting things mixed up. And gradually the family see a decline in the person's ability to manage the things they used to do. They can't follow a recipe anymore. They can't make a shopping list and do the shopping anymore. They can't manage their finances anymore. So it's a cognitive decline. And then the third one is undoubtedly one of the more difficult ones, not because of its prevalence, but because when it does come in, it's usually very emotional, and that's ability to drive. Especially the males in the community love to drive a car. It's been very handy. They've done it for the last 50, 60, 70 years, and it's almost an extension of their body, the dear car. And if you see that they no longer have the dexterity or the ability to think where they are at one time, their spatial orientation, so the ability to know where the car is on the road and what's going on, how to manage the controls of the car, how to get out of the driveways without problems, this can be due to a number of things. It doesn't just have to be the way they can think anymore, remember things. It can sometimes just be their physical ability to turn from side to side, or whether they've got shakes associated with central tremors or Parkinson's disease, whether their sight is now not good enough to drive anymore. And there's certain physical things that you have to do to be able to pass a driving test, but we might talk about those later.
Yeah, absolutely. It is going to be one of those aspects of aging that we are going to talk about in a few moments. But you've raised three really big concerns or issues in themselves. And then you could have someone come into your clinic, into your practice, who might be exhibiting all three. And how complex is that? I don't know where you would start with that conversation. It's very difficult. So you've explained that, particularly the driving, really looking forward to chatting about that. I think you've highlighted some possible concerns that people, well, they might be concerned, but they don't understand the context of how it all fits with an aging loved one, you know, at this point. In the aged care sector, when people have a home care package, they can use their funding to pay for clinical support. It's recommended that people see their GP first, though, and explore the possibility of getting a chronic disease management plan or a team care arrangement. Can you explain these options, Gary? Are they the same or different?
So they're part of the whole deal. They're different, but they're the same. So there you go. I sound like a politician. What happens, general practice is nothing like it used to be. General practice used to be somewhere where you went, you had something wrong with you, the doctor tried to fix it up, and you went away and things were fine. But now general practice is so much more a management of chronic disease processes because we're all living the longer. And as we live longer, we develop all these other conditions that our forebears never had the chance to come down with because they simply didn't live long enough. So aged care is becoming more complex. There's a lot more going on. And there are numerous things that are present within a patient's history that may need increased attention. And we can give them the increased attention in a couple of ways. The first thing is recognizing them. And by recognizing them, I think that's where the use of a GP management plan can be very helpful. A GP management plan is simply a plan put together by your GP and the patient that outlines the current situation with all the patient's current issues, everything from the most important down to the seemingly trivial but still needs some attention or regular follow-up. And of course, what's important to the patient may not be important to the GP. GP's often worried about the big ticket items that are not causing the patient any symptoms. The patient's worried about the corn on their foot that sore when they walked over the road the other day. So there are different perspectives there. The whole perspective has to be taken, the whole patient, and that's the important part of a GP management plan. It identifies your health needs and care needs, that is the patient, and it lists the actions that you can take to manage those, strategies that you can put in place to try and address them. Now, the second part of this is team care arrangements. So team care arrangements concerns the strategies that are put in place to help achieve the goals that you've outlined in your plan. Now, this was really a big issue only in recent years because Medicare didn't pay for you to see allied health personnel. They didn't pay to see physios, didn't pay to see occupational therapists, dietitians, chiropractors, and the like. It now can do that or can pay a proportion of their fee by the use of the patient having a GP management plan that is linked to team care arrangements. And the team care arrangements enables Medicare benefits to be paid for up to 5 services per calendar year if it's clinically indicated. So, I mean, if you've got a problem with your shoulder that's got osteoarthritis in it, you can't have a team care arrangement with a podiatrist to look after your long toenails. It's not appropriate. The team care arrangement has to be for a condition that has been present for 6 months or is likely to be present for 6 months. That is, it has to be a chronic condition. Now, the plans have to be reviewed on a regular basis. It's usually every 6 months we review these, but occasionally things change and they have to be done more frequently, especially so with diabetes. People have a lot of control issues and you sometimes have to update them. The important thing to remember is the care plan is a liquid, ongoing, fluid thing. It goes on and has changes as we go along. And if it doesn't get changed after 2 years, you're usually missing something, frankly. There's something not being included. So the GP and the practice nurse have to review the goals and look at the strategies and then adapt any referrals to the allied health people that are necessary.
That's such a wonderfully detailed explanation of that. Are there any qualifying conditions that allow a person to be eligible for one of these types of plans? Like you've just highlighted, they must have had a condition for 6 months. Potentially it needs to be ongoing, but are there specific conditions within those parameters that a person must exhibit?
I suppose if you look at the history of the people who get referred for team care arrangements, the majority have the chronic diseases we're used to. We're used to diabetes, we're used to heart disease, we're used to osteoarthritis problems. So the diabetes people going off to see the diabetic educators or the dietitians, maybe the exercise physiologists. The people with heart disease going off to see the dietitians, maybe the exercise physiologists to help with their diet and exercise. The people with osteoarthritis maybe going off to see the physiotherapist or the chiropractors. But remembering they only have 5 visits in that calendar year, and that's not 5 visits to the physio and 5 visits to the diabetes educator and 5 visits there. 5 visits total. So if you want to see more than one allied health person, it might be 2 and 3 or 1 and 4. But generally speaking, you go to the one that's going to give you the most bang for buck, the one that is the best, going to give you the best pathway to good health for your condition. So yeah, other ones would be asthma, kidney disease, neurological disorders, you know, things like Parkinson's. People have problems with balance and strength and ability to move around. And exercise physiologists, physios can be really valuable for those as well. And then you've got respiratory problems, chronic emphysema, things like this. These people are also included. But I'd say the commonest ones would definitely be diabetes, osteoarthritis, or frailty, perhaps, in general. It doesn't just have to be. It can be just deconditioning rather than a specific osteoarthritis that requires a review by, say, the physiotherapists or the like. They're the common ones.
I think 5 subsidised visits in a year is not enough.
I totally agree.
Yeah. And then there's a mental health care plan. That's another type of care plan that GPs can prescribe. What does that look like, Gary?
Okay. So it's completely separate to the GP management plan. You can have a GP management plan that refers you off to a psychologist, but it is far better and far financially far better off with the patient using a mental health care plan. Mental health care plan still has to list the other physical ailments and other things that the patient has to deal with. However, the focus is most definitely on the social, family, emotional, and psychological well-being of the patient, the past emotional or stress issues, and the ongoing issues, be they in any of those areas that the patient is facing at this point in time, where talking with your GP or counselling with your GP has failed to really help. Maybe medication has been trialled, but without significant success. And maybe you don't want to go on the medications. Many people don't want to go on medication and would rather go through talk therapy. And now we've got the ability to use psychologists with talk therapy. That's just great. It really allows us to get a better management plan going for those patients through the GP mental health plans. Now, the difference there is the referral that goes with the mental health plan. You need a mental health plan first. You don't just write a letter to a psychologist. So you need the plan put down. You need the goals. You need to know various things to do with who are the people are going to be your main supports. What are you going to do in case of crises? There's a number of things that must be included in that plan. Another thing that must be included in that plan is a quantitative measure of what's going on, of your depression or your anxiety or your stress levels. That's required for it to be compliant with the Medicare item number. Once the mental health plan has been submitted, that opens the door for the psychologist to be able to bill the patient and the patients to get a rebate from Medicare. Now, psychologists vary in their experience and the prices that they'll ask. It's very rare to have a private psychologist who will accept the Medicare rebate as the total cost, so there's virtually always a gap. However, for people who are on a pension or a healthcare card, there is the option of going through a different section. Connection to Wellbeing used to be the one where you can write a referral off. It goes off to a group of psychologists who determine who would be best in their group of psychologists who will bulk bill Medicare for seeing that patient. Obviously, even though it's for people on healthcare cards or pensions, there's still a backlog. It takes you a lot longer to get in to see that group of people simply because of the numbers of people who are elderly who will be wanting to use that because they have the ability to use their healthcare card or pension. If you do have private health cover, it's not very frequently that you'll find that your health cover will give you more back for your visit to the psychologist privately than the Medicare rebate. So I think generally you're better off going through a GP mental health plan to start with and see how you go. The first referral for the mental health plan to a psychologist, it involves up to 6 visits, depending upon how the psychologist feels you're going. After 6 visits, the psychologist has to send a note back to the GP stating where they've got to, how things are going, and whether or not they feel the patient could benefit from further tests, from further sessions. And that being done, the GP, if they agree with the psychologist that further sessions are needed, we'll do a mental health plan review, send another referral off to the psychologist requesting further sessions, and so goes on. The number of those sessions seems to vary with governments as they come and go, so I never predict what it's going to be at any point in time. It was an extra 4, but then another extra 6 in certain circumstances. But yeah, don't quote me on it because the latest information might be different again.
Well, the fact that people can possibly get up to 10 sessions with a psychologist as opposed to 5 in a functional context with a physio or an occupational therapist, I just think that's so wonderful. And I'm guessing here that an older person might have a mental health care plan as well as a teen care arrangement. So is that possible, Gary? Can they have both at once?
You can have both at the same time, absolutely. Right. Your term care arrangement, if it's for any other things, you know, physiotherapy, et cetera, yep, that goes on. Mental health is completely separate as far as that is concerned. If for some reason you no longer can use your GP mental health plan, and I've never had this situation arise, you could probably go back and do a GP management plan and do a term care arrangement to a psychologist, but the rebate involved with that to the psychologist would be significantly less and would only be 5 visits in a calendar year.
Right. Interesting. So, listeners, I think the take-home message is that if you were unaware of a mental health care plan and you were accessing psychology through a GP management plan or teen care arrangement, go back to your GP and have another conversation, because it sounds much more beneficial that you might be able to access both of these options, and financially sounds like it's a bit more beneficial for you as well in the rebates from Medicare.
Community pharmacies keep Australia healthy. With 6,000 locations nationwide, they're open early, late and longer for convenient, accessible and safe care. Pharmacists provide home medicine reviews, dose administration aids and essential vaccinations. Thanks to additional training, many can now treat common conditions like ear infections, wounds, and skin issues. They also support management of chronic conditions in partnership with your healthcare team. Ask your pharmacist how they can help you and your family stay well.
Gary, a GP can assist a person apply for a disability parking permit, can't they? And what does this involve? Talk us through, because maybe I, you know, the interpretation or the language I've used, disability parking permit, might throw people off straight away. Is that what we call it?
That's exactly what it's called. And compared with what we've been discussing, this is very straightforward. Disability car parks, you see them around all the place. The round circles, blue with the wheelchair in white, that are close to various supermarket shopping centres or strip shops on major roads. It simply enables people to park closer to the appropriate destinations. And it can be, the application can be completed by your GP reasonably easily, especially if they know you well. It's usually done with regard to physical disability. So it's usually to do with arthritis, maybe pain, back pain, leg pain, knee pain, hip pain. A lot of people might have four-wheel walkers, or walking sticks, other walking aids that may be necessary. So pain issues and arthritis are very commonly used. Problems of just balance and the like, again, I refer back to, say, Parkinson's, or perhaps having a previous stroke where you've got weakness down one side. Breathing problems, problems with angina that can't be managed in any other way. So people have got their stable angina, but they always get their angina after they walk more than 100, maybe 100 metres. Vision difficulties and just plain frailty. Just your body is now frail. You're very prone to falls. You don't want to be walking large distances. It's self-evident that you need. And there's no real extra explanations to be made there. The GP can fill out the form, say, yes, I believe this person needs to have a disability parking permit. And then that is sent away to the Department of Main Roads. And within a few weeks, you'll get your certificate, you attach to the windscreen of your car, and that enables you to use one of those parking spots.
Gary, does the person have to get the form from Department of Transport or Department of Main Roads and bring it to you? Or is that a form that you have within your suite?
No, we can download that from the internet. So we can do it at the time. Most of the forms that we're talking about here are downloadable. So the patient very rarely has to bring them in with them. In fact, pretty much never, apart from some of the Centrelink forms for completely unrelated things that we're talking about today.
Okay. So with regards to driving still, if a family member was concerned about their older loved one's ability to drive, what is the process of investigating if a person is still safe to drive?
Well, I guess the first thing is, from the age of 75, everyone has an annual medical to assess their ability to drive. So they have to see a GP. And if they don't carry that little piece of paper that authorises the fact that they can drive, the medical certificate, with their license when they're pulled over by police for whatever reason, they're basically driving without a license and will be fined and maybe lose their license as well. So that needs to be done. That's the first statement. It's also one of the most difficult things as a general practitioner that I have to do for reasons that we discussed earlier. It's very hard to separate patients from their wheels. It's part of their mobility. Without them, they feel quite lost. And there's a sense of dependency on other people, which as we grow older is the last thing we want to feel, dependent. So that can be an issue. Knowing the patient is really important because you've got a fair idea of how good they are. You know their past history, you know what they can do, what they can't do. You've got a fair idea of what their cognitive state is, how well they think, how well they reason things out. You see them walk to and fro the waiting room. You see them just get up, sit down, move around. You see they haven't got any shakes. You do their vision tests, obviously, when you do the medical for their driving license. And you get a good assessment of their cognitive condition as well. But if you're in doubt, and usually the doubt comes from cognition, that becomes a little bit more difficult. And this is where it gets grey. And this is where I've had some of the biggest arguments with patients that I've had in my career, where I say, sorry, Bill or Joe or Sam, and it's usually the males, I can't give you a license to drive at the moment. And if I think they're going to go off and drive, I have a responsibility to go to the Department of Main Roads and inform them that Bill or Joe or Sam hasn't passed his driving test today, to alert them and flag it. So that could be the end of a very, you know, long and happy relationship between a GP and a patient on occasions, but it might save a life or the lives of others if they're involved in a motor car accident. It's important to get collateral information from relatives. If a relative comes in and they say, I'm worried about that, I'm worried about mum, I'm not sure they can drive, that's extra information for me, because I think, well, if they're not happy about it and there's no ulterior motive here, and they would say to me, there's no way known I'd let my children be driven around by my grandfather or grandmother, then I've got a fairly good reason to say, I've got to find a reason why I should let this person drive rather than why I can't let them drive. And usually in situations like that, the patient's relatives are correct. Of course, there is the option of getting a driving assessment done. There is a service provided by an OT in Cairns who does driving assessment, occupational therapy assessments of ability to drive. They're expensive. They cost over $600. But trust me, if people are going to lose their license and they dispute it, they don't blink at the possibility of saving their license by paying $600 and proving that terrible doctor wrong. Unfortunately, I think in all but one occasion, the OTs agreed with me and said, no, they shouldn't be driving.
Does the GP assist a carer to apply for the carer's allowance or carer payment, Gary?
Yeah. So this is also something that's often done in general practice. A lot of people don't know this payment even exists. Oh. So people who are in the community being cared for a lot or a little by usually a relative, usually a family member, can be rewarded with a carer allowance or a carer payment, depending upon the degree of help that they require. So the carer allowance is the smaller of these payments. It's a nominal amount that's given, perhaps enough to pay for some medication that they would otherwise get. And it gives a small amount of recompense for someone who's been helping out with minor tasks, maybe minor issues to do with bathing or dressing or meals or shopping or things like this. So there has to be a deficit that the patient has that this person needs to fulfill. If they weren't there, someone else would have to come in and do it.
Mm-hmm.
That's the allowance. Small amount of help only required. If the amount of help is far more substantial, in other words, you really need to help that person around 8 hours a day, so virtually therefore living with them, that's the carer payment. It's not a lot of money, but it's substantially more than the allowance. And it involves basically helping the person get out of bed, helping them to the shower, helping them dress, helping them get their foods ready, helping them eat their food sometimes, dropping it up, etc. And then mobilising, getting lists ready, helping with finances, anything along those lines. But it has to be for a substantial amount of time. Right. And that's outlined on the forms that are completed. And again, those forms are downloadable and you just have to see your GP. Your GP will have access to them on the net.
Wonderful. One less slightly stressful thing that probably a distressed carer has to think about.
Sure.
Come to the GP and have that conversation. As prescribers of the older person's medications, do GPs monitor the number of medications a person is taking? And are there indications for reducing the number of medications a person takes?
Yeah, look, we've already discussed in some small detail the fact that we're all living longer and we're all getting more chronic illnesses. And I look at some of my patients' medication lists at times and think, my, what can we do to decrease this pill burden? And I sometimes look through and realise, oh, you know, there's 16 medications there and unfortunately they need every single one of them. If there's a doubt, so the other thing, of course, is we're seeing multiple doctors nowadays too. So you may have someone who sees their GP. They may have two GPs or three GPs. They may see one GP for their heart, one GP for their gynecology problems, one GP for their skin. Then they'll see their respiratory specialist for their emphysema, and they might see their heart specialist, and they might also have to go and see their psychiatrist as well. So there's a plethora of medical people putting potentially medications into the pot that this person has to take their pills from every day. It gets hard to even recognise which pills are which for the people who are prescribing them, let alone the patient who's thinking, I've got the red one, the yellow one, the green one, the one with the orange spots. I don't know which one I'm taking, what I'm taking them for anymore. It gets quite confusing. So deprescribing has become increasingly an important factor in medicine today, and we've all been encouraged to do our best to look at the medications patients are on and look at the possibility of deprescribing. In my case, when I had the patient with the 16 medications, I routinely asked when I sent off to specialists that patient's need for the medications they're on from their perspective. And occasionally I got the answer, yeah, well, we can try and do this and this, and we'll go from 4 down to 2. Well, that's a big bonus. That's 2 less per day. Or sometimes they write back and say, no, Gary, they need everyone that they're taking. From my perspective, you might like to tell the psychiatrist not to use this one or this one. And so I'll write my next letter to the psychiatrist. How about we stop those? Cardiologist doesn't like them. And the psychiatrist is more than likely to say, well, I think they need an extra one. So we're going to increase it to 3 now, which is frustrating. And that's not only for me, but also for the patient. The other thing we can do that's very helpful is a home medicines review. Now, home medicines review is done by a pharmacist. So your GP sends a letter to the pharmacist after discussion with you about this, that the pharmacist will read over. The pharmacist will look at your current medications and also the current illnesses that you take those medications for and decide, okay, I can see some possibilities here, but I'm going to go and see you. So they visit the patient in their home and they basically say to the patient, I want to look at all your medications. I want you to empty them here on the kitchen table, everything you've got in the medicine cupboard. And it's surprising what they can find. I had one pharmacist report to me that they had 44 different medications that this patient put on the medicine cupboard. Some of them were 10 years old that hadn't been used, but they're put in the back of the cupboard just in case. I'll keep them just in case. So just in case is not good. So it was helpful in that patient was able to kind of dispose, or the pharmacist actually took them with her, bless her. And she said, you won't be using this anymore. You don't need them. They're all out of date and they're going to cause you problems. Patient was happy for them to go. And then the pharmacist can come back and say, well, look, the patient hasn't had a B12 level done from the investigations you've shown me for a period of time. They're still taking B12 injections. I know they're not at home, you're giving them there, but maybe we should repeat the B12 level and see whether that's necessary. The vitamin D they're taking, they were put on that a long time ago. They've now got a far more active lifestyle because they've been out more to try and deal with their brittle bones. So maybe we need to do their vitamin D levels again, and we can see whether we need to continue them on that one. And then they might point out that certain medications potentially could be put into a combination pill, because especially with the blood pressure pills these days, we have some pills that are doubling up. So we can take that one. They're together as a combination pill, which means taking one pill instead of two. And finally, interestingly, they can also say, Gary, you've got these two patients here, this patient on these two medications here. I don't think they're going to go well together. I think that's going to potentially cause some problems. And that's a wake-up call for me to say, right, I need to look at those and see what we can change. So it's not only de-prescribing, it's also helping with appropriate prescribing in case something has happened since the patient was put on that medication that I have to look at. And the classic example would be a patient who was put on drug like metformin, which is commonly used, but their renal function's gone down and now is too bad for that drug to be appropriate. Now, not saying that I do that, but that's a good example that I've seen. And we should stop that medication because it's now dangerous for that patient to use. So home medicine reviews can be very helpful.
And Gary, how does that get paid for? Medicare pays for that.
So Medicare pays for the doctor to write the referral to the pharmacist and follow up with the patient to discuss the findings. And that's usually bulk billed. In fact, I think it's almost universally bulk billed. And the pharmacist also gets paid by Medicare for going out, looking at the history, looking at the medications, going out and doing the home visit, and reporting back to the GP.
That's excellent.
It's very, very good. And it's similar to what happens in the nursing homes. Nursing homes have to have these medication reviews on a regular basis, and pharmacists have been doing those for many, many years. They've also been doing the home medicine reviews for a long time as well, and they're still probably underutilised, if the truth be known.
Maybe up to today, some more people will go to their GPs and have this kind of discussion. That would be great.
Hopefully they can get an appointment in a reasonable time.
Well, That's the other thing. Yeah.
That's a topic for another day.
So medication mismanagement is something that I see from time to time. If you become aware that an older person is forgetting their medications or, gosh, what if they're double dosing? How do you approach this?
Okay, so forgetting medications is common. It's common. And you sometimes see it when patients bring in all the medications they have because you've asked them and you see that some of the medications are out of date, some are unused, some are unopened, and you're thinking there's something going wrong here. I wonder whether this patient is taking all the medications I'm asking them. Sometimes you ask the patient and they simply say, oh, well, I sometimes forget, or, oh, I'm feeling okay now, so I don't need to take it. Well, sorry, it's a blood pressure medication. You probably do. So some patients will own up. Others, you'll have to kind of investigate a little further. Occasionally, patients come in, they bring in a Webster pack that contains little plastic push-outs for their various pills. And you see through the week that a number of these plastic pods haven't been opened. And you say, what's happened? And the patient says, oh, I must have missed them. So it's common, but it doesn't seem to necessarily worry them too much. The important thing is that the patient is getting the medications. So you have to do as much as you can to try and make sure the patient gets the medication in a form that will remind them to take it or remind you to take all of them at the right time. If you have to sit down in the morning and say, now, I think I take 6 tablets in the morning, one of those, or is it one of those or one of those, I forget. And they go and read the label, but they haven't got their glasses on, so it's difficult to work out. If you can have all the pills for the morning, if there's some at midday, then midday. If there's some at night, then night. Packed away nicely in a little pack that they don't have to make up themselves. We know that's going to improve the compliance, despite the fact that I just mentioned the person who came in with the Webster pack with the unused portions. So Webster packs are good. They come in a flat sheet that you can just push out, and I kind of like those ones. But they also come in rolls, so plastic rolls, where you can have a roll of medications that last a week. I think the medication for a flat pack is $5.50 a week, I think, and for a roll is $5 a month. So the roll is certainly cheaper for the patient, but it's a nominal price really compared to the amount of work the pharmacist has to do to fix it all up. The only problems can be if the doctor then goes and changes the medications around and the patient's only halfway through their pack or their roll. That kind of is an irritation to the pharmacist. But sometimes we can say, don't worry, wait until the next week before you start the new medication. And sometimes if it's an antibiotic, we simply ask the patient to remember to take that antibiotic for those 5 or 7 days that are necessary. And you try to use an antibiotic that's once or twice a day rather than 4 times a day, because you know the majority of people are not going to remember 4 times a day antibiotics.
I think I'm one of those people.
I'm one of those people too.
Look, Gary, the conversation today has really been fantastic and we're getting close to closing, but I just slipped in one more talking point that I want to ask you about.
Yep.
How often should a person see their GP?
And that's a very hard question.
I'll just add to that. If a person says, I'm fine, I don't need to see my doctor, and we know it's been 12 months since they saw their GP, like, to me, that's not really okay.
I agree. We all know how often we have to see our dentist. There's no rules about that, about seeing a GP. It really depends on how well you are. There are minimums. You should see a GP at least annually. And probably from the age of 50 onwards, that would be mandatory. Before that, you could argue to and fro. If there are medical issues that have been bubbling, then certainly that's the case. From the age of 65 on, I think most people tend to be having a medical issue or maybe medication that requires a review by a GP in any way, in any case. The problem there is now we have phone consultations and a lot of people will ring up and just say, I just need some scripts. I just need a phone consultation. Haven't got time to come in, et cetera. And whilst that might be great for the patient, saves time waiting around, and probably great for the GP in a small, short appointment, and you don't have to worry about calling the patient, getting them sitting down, doing everything else, it's not necessarily good medicine because you miss that opportunity to ask them how they are, ask them more specific questions about their health in general, do their blood pressure, check their pulse, maybe have them listen to their kicker. and just see if anything's brewing that they're simply unaware of. Maybe notice that their weight has gone down 5 kilos since you last weighed them. And why have you been trying to lose weight? No, well, I hadn't noticed the belt's been going in a bit. What's happening there? Maybe notice the opposite. They have been putting on weight, and maybe we need to check their cholesterol again, because last time when I gave you cholesterol form, it looks as though you haven't got it done. Oh, yes, I lost it. That's right. So that can be an issue as well. So generally speaking, yeah, annual review would be the minimum, just to touch base, make sure things are going okay. From the point of view of most patients I see, which are invariably the older generation with chronic illnesses, a lot of them I have to see every 4 to 6 weeks, simply because their conditions are up and down all over the place, which is hard because, yeah, I'm nearing retirement and not working many hours anymore.
A funny thing, I had a client yesterday, and I always ask my clients locally, of course, you know, in the Cairns area, who's your GP? And they said, Gary Hartrick. And I said, oh, that's fantastic. You've got a great GP. Gary's so thorough. And the gentleman said, yeah, but I can never get into him. He's so busy. So I know you've just said you're moving towards retirement, but I think half of Cairns would prefer you to not retire, Gary.
Well, I'm sure there's probably someone out there who's more than happy for me to retire. Not the least my wife, Mahita, no doubt. But yeah, look, it's hard. And it'll be hard to say goodbye to all the patients, et cetera. But at this point in time, part-time medicine suits me well. And I enjoy the teaching side, which is also handy. So that's good.
Look, I just want to say a huge thank you for the time that you've spent with me today discussing how a GP can support their older patients, and for the clarification on all those programs that people might not be aware they can access by their GP. Listeners, next week, Anna Melliser joins me again, and we'll be talking more about support at home, with a particular focus on the group of people who come into the system, or who have come into the aged care system from September the 12th, and what that might look like for them as we move towards July 1st. I have no doubt you've had some benefit and learnt a lot from my conversation with Gary this afternoon. Gary, thank you again. It's been an absolute pleasure chatting with you.
Thanks very much, Coral, and all the best.
Hey, care community. Thanks for listening to this episode. So you never miss a show, make sure you subscribe to our podcast. If you'd like to know more about what we do, head to our website, cmeacn.com.au.